Daniel, Chapter 8, the 10th talk in a series on Daniel, was presented by David Crabtree on June 21, 2020, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 10, Daniel, Chapter 8, accompanies this talk.
Welcome, everybody, to Reformation Fellowship, the virtual edition. I'd like to wish everybody, all the fathers, a happy Father's Day. I was thinking about this. It seems to me that Mother's Day, mothers are more important. That's the really important job in our culture and our society. And I think it's important that we recognize mothers. But there's a sense in which I think Father's Day is more important, because I think mothers will mother for the most part. That's kind of built into being a mother, that the motherly instinct is very strong. It seems to me that for fathers, the fathering instinct is not nearly as strong. And so there's a sense in which Father's Day is probably more important, because fathers need more encouragement to take on the responsibility that's been given to them. But I would like to thank all of the fathers who take their responsibility seriously, because it's such an important job. So happy Father's Day. Okay, we're going to look at Daniel chapter 8. In many ways, chapter 8 is closely related to the vision that was in chapter 7. As you'll recall, chapter 7 was a turn in the book of Daniel, in the sense that prior to chapter 7, the book had been historical narrative about Daniel and his adventures, and the adventures of his friends, and visions that came to kings that Daniel interpreted. With chapter 7, it's quite different. It's no longer historical narrative, as we've seen, but it's a series of visions that Daniel himself has. And we'll see that there will be 1, 2, 3, kind of 4 of them in the rest of the book. This continues that. This is another vision that comes to Daniel. There's a lot of overlap in content, in meaning, between chapter 7 and chapter 8. But the imagery is different. He's going to be talking about some of the same empires, and some of the same kinds of themes, but it's completely different imagery. The animals in chapter 7 were those mishvezen, the hybrid animals that were part one thing and part another thing. In this chapter, that's not the case. They're domesticated animals. It's a ram and it's a goat. So it's very different in that respect, but in content, it overlaps significantly. In this chapter is going to emphasize the interaction between the two beasts. We didn't see that kind of thing in last chapter. In this chapter, that's the focus. And then it will switch to talking about the horn that emerges from one of those two beasts. And that is actually at the heart of this vision. And in meaning, this vision is going to talk about the implication of these empires interacting and the implication of that interaction between the empires for the land of Israel. So it's much more focused, and it turns its attention towards Israel specifically. And I've talked before about the fact that half of this book is written in Hebrew and half of it is Aramaic. It is Aramaic from chapters 2 through 7. And in those chapters, it's really the primary audience, I would argue, is the Gentiles, the nations. But when you get to chapter 8, it switches to Hebrew. And I think the primary audience is the people of Israel. And the focus from now on is the impact of these nations on Israel, the land of Israel. As it says in the first verse of chapter 8, this happens in the third year of Belshazzar, which is approximately 549. And I sent my notes to Robbie, and she pointed out that I had 550 in here, and that wasn't 3 years from the last vision. And it says the last vision was in the first year of Belshazzar. This is in the third. The dates that people give vary by 1 or 2 years. So that just makes it difficult to be precise. The significance of the third year of Belshazzar as king of Babylon is that it was at that time that Cyrus, who was king of the, and I think he was king of the Persians, united the Medes and the Persians into one kingdom. Now, it appears that Cyrus was of both Median and Persian lineage. He had both in his background. But I think he's the king of Persia. But he merges the two countries, kingdoms. It becomes one entity. And that happens in 549. And it is significant that the book of Daniel was written after Cyrus takes control of Babylon and sends the Jews back to Jerusalem. So this is kind of a hint of what's coming up, that is the liberation of the Jews in Babylon and the return of those Jews back to Jerusalem. That's not far off. This chapter is a very difficult chapter. It's the most difficult chapter in Daniel so far. I know there's a passage in chapter 9 that people say is one of the most difficult chapters in the Old Testament, but I found this chapter particularly difficult. I wrote 3 different outlines for this chapter and was finishing up the last one last night, which is a problem because now as I go through it, I'm not going to remember which version I'm working from right now, and I'll probably mix it up with versions that I had before. But there are a lot of very difficult interpretive decisions that have to be made in this passage. And I didn't have time to research those difficult decisions as much as they call for and as I would like to have done. So what I'm going to say is, represents my thinking as it stands today. And I reserve the right to change my mind tomorrow. But this is what I think is going on in this chapter at this point in time. I've made some important interpretive decisions that really need to be further researched, but I'm just going to present it as the way, it's just the way that I see it at this point. I'm going to go through the chapter section by section. And like I say, it's another vision that overlaps a lot with what was in chapter 7, But in chapter 7, I went through the whole chapter, and then I went through the interpretation. This time, I'm going to do it a little bit differently. The first part of the vision, there's no question as to what these animals signify because this tells us in the text. So in the first part, I'm going to talk about the historical reality behind the vision a little bit. And I'll work out my way through the chapter, mixing in the historical reality with the elements of the vision until we get to the small horn. And I'll talk about that a little bit, and then I'll talk more about the historical reality behind that. So that's my plan of attack. Let's get started. Daniel 8, verses 1 through 4. In the third year of King Belshazzar's reign, I, Daniel, had a vision after the one that had already appeared to me. In my vision, I saw myself at the citadel of Susa in the province of Elam. In the vision, I was beside the Ulai Canal. I looked up, and there before me was a ram with two horns standing beside the canal, and the horns were long. One of the horns was longer than the other, but grew up later. I watched the ram as he charged toward the west and the north and the south. No animal could stand against him, and none could rescue him from his power. None could rescue from his power. He did as he pleased and became great. Okay, this text here states that this vision was subsequent to the vision of the four beasts in chapter 7, encouraging us to relate the two, make a connection between the two. It continues in the first person, as was most of chapter 7. But if you remember, chapter 7 started out at the very beginning. The introduction to the vision was in third person. And then it switched to first person for the rest of the chapter. Chapter 8 is first person throughout. We'll see that chapter 9 is first person throughout. 10 starts in third person for one verse, and then it switches over to first person. In the vision, it says that Daniel is transported to Susa. Now, Susa became, at a time later than this, where Daniel is living at the time that Daniel is alive, Susa became the most important of the capitals of the Persian Empire. The Persian Empire had several different capitals. It moved depending on who the king was and where he wanted to have his palace and all that sort of thing. But Susa became one of the most important of the capitals of the Persian Empire. It's not clear during the time of this vision whether it's being seen as the capital of Persia. In fact, it's not clear that Susa was a really important city at the time of Daniel. We don't know for sure. There's some people who say that it was not, but it's not, the evidence is not clear. It says that he looks at the citadel. Susa was a fortified city. It was a highly fortified city because it was such an important capital. It is possible that Daniel visited Susa as part of his official duties working for the king of Babylon, maybe earlier. But if he did, Susa probably was not a highly developed city like it became later. In any case, Daniel is visiting there in the vision, not bodily. He's not actually there. He's there in the vision. How he knows it's Susa and all that sort of thing is not clear. I don't know if he saw inscriptions or if he was familiar with the place. None of that is clear. He's by the canal Ulai. It is interesting that in these prophetic visions, it's not uncommon for the prophet to be near some body of water. And he is here. He's by the canal of Ulai. This canal is apparently either the river or a branch of the river that flows through Susa. And this appears to be the Semitic name for that canal. The Persian name is Calaspes, and it flowed through the city of Susa. And this canal will be significant later on in the vision. We'll get to that. Daniel sees a ram with two horns. It says both horns are long, but one horn started out shorter and grew quickly and became longer than the other horn. So Daniel must have seen that taking place, the horn growing. As we learn later in the vision, the ram represents the Medo-Persians. And the two horns are representative of the Medes and the Persians. When the Medes and the Persians first united, the Medes were the greater of the two kingdoms. They were more powerful and more significant. But as time went on, the Persians became much more significant, became the dominant group in the empire. And so usually you hear it called the Persian Empire because they became so dominant for so long at a later time. And Elam, by the way, the people of Elam were apparently the core of the Persian people. They were right in the center of the Persian people. Now this ram starts charging in three different directions. It goes to the north, it goes to the west, it goes to the south. The only direction it doesn't go is east. Now, if we look at the historical reality behind the Persian Empire, it expanded, really they expanded in all four directions, but very little to the east. They didn't go very far in the east. Most of their expansion was to the north first. They went towards Lydia in Asia Minor, Anatolia, and towards the land that was controlled by the Scythians. They went to the south as far as Egypt, and they went to the west, and west from Elam is Babylon and Syria. So they went in those directions primarily, those three directions. And that would fit with the vision. It says no animals were able to withstand his charges, and that's true, that when Persia was at the height of its power, no one was able to withstand them. Later on, there were some significant stands made against Persian incursions, especially the Greeks, but in the early years, nobody was able to withstand them. And it says, and he did as he pleased, and that seems to be common here as a common way of indicating that these kings could go where they wanted to go. They were so powerful, they could do what they wanted to do. Nobody could stand against them. Verses 5 through 8. And as I was thinking about this, suddenly a goat with a prominent horn between his eyes came from the west, crossing the whole earth without touching the ground. He came toward the two-horned ram I had seen standing beside the canal and charged at him in great rage. I saw him attack the ram furiously, striking the ram and shattering his two horns. The ram was powerless to stand against him. The goat knocked him to the ground and trampled on him, and none could rescue the ram from his power. The goat became very great, but at the height of his power, his large horn was broken off, and in its place, four prominent horns grew up toward the four winds of heaven. So we've got a male goat coming from the west. And this male goat only has one horn, and that's right smack between his eyes. Babylonian army that Alexander put together. Alexander's father, Philip, was the first really prominent king of Macedonia. Macedonia was a Greekish culture, a Greekish nation, just north of Greece proper. So the Greeks looked on the Macedonians as being from the sticks. They were kind of backwoods types from the Greek perspective. Uncultured and all that sort of thing. But the Greeks were never able to unify and stay unified. They fought among themselves. And so they never became a great world power. The Macedonians, however, had a different history. And Philip of Macedon was able to put together a significant army. And he led the effort of the Macedonians' conquest of Greece. Then he died. Alexander, who had actually helped his father in the conquest of Greece, took over, and Alexander's the one then who becomes the well-known ruler of an empire that he puts together using Macedonian and the Macedonian army as his power. Comes from the west, that's exactly right. The Macedonians came from the west across the channel from Istanbul, from Turkey. It says he didn't even touch the ground. Alexander conquered a huge empire, one larger than the Persians had had, and he does it in a remarkably short period of time. Golden Gate says over a period of 4 years between 334 and 331, Alexander demolished the Persian Empire and established an empire of his own extending from Europe to India. It is amazing to read stories of his conquest. It's just phenomenal. They moved at lightning speed. So in 4 years to conquer that large of an area was absolutely unprecedented. Probably even unimaginable to people living at the time. So this goat arrives at the place where the ram is standing, which is by the canal. And that's the canal, that's right where Daniel is standing in his vision, is by this canal. And that's where Alexander defeated the Persian. That's the final defeat of the Persians. He'd already beat their army at an earlier time in Asia Minor before he went down and conquered Egypt. But then he looped back to the capital of Persia and defeated the Persian king right on his doorstep. It says that it attacked the ram with raging strength. Some commentators argue, and they use some quotes to say that Alexander was mad, was motivated by anger to defeat the Persians. I don't think that that's the case. I don't think that anger was what drove him. You can find some quotes where he's angry towards the Persians, but that seems to be more as a way of motivating his troops to carry on the conquest. Alexander the Great, his army, the backbone of his army was mercenary troops. And that's the way that Philip had done it as well. Alexander, therefore, needs to be able to pay his soldiers. For him to have power, he has to keep paying them. That's the problem with mercenary troops. And so after he's conquered Greece, he's looking around, what am I going to do now? And he knows that if he's going to stay strong, he has to have a lot of money. And he knows from his experience that there is a lot of money in Persia. So there's no question what direction he needs to go. He's got to go east. He's got to go where the money is. And that's exactly what he does. And he does. He conquers a lot of territory where there is a lot of wealth. And that is what makes it possible for him to keep going, as he can keep paying more and more troops to be involved in his effort. So it's not, he wasn't angry at Persia, I don't think. And I don't think the vision needs to be taken as he was angry at Persia. It's just that he attacked them like an angry goat. And he did. He attacked them viciously, brutally. It says that the goat threw the ram to the ground and trampled it. We've seen this trampling expression used frequently, and we'll see it many more times before we're through with Daniel. The goat just obliterates the ram. And no one could deliver the ram from its power. There's nobody that Persia can turn to that would be capable of stopping Alexander. And then the goat acted more arrogantly, and that's true, that they were encouraged by their victories. Alexander was encouraged by his victories and his troops, and they just keep moving. It's just too much fun. Then the horn of the goat was broken. So right at the height of its power, this one horn is broken. What happened with Alexander's army is he kept moving east, and he kept having victories until he gets to India. And there he has a minor setback. And his troops start saying, "We're tired. We're tired of just conquering new cities. We want to go back home and enjoy the wealth that we have accumulated." So there's kind of a mini revolt against Alexander. So Alexander decides, I can't go on. So he decides to go back. And on the way back, Alexander gets sick. And I think he makes it back to Persia. But then soon thereafter, he dies. So that's the end. And without Alexander, there's no one that would be able to mount the same kind of power, put together the same kind of power that Alexander was able to do. So the empire kind of falls apart, as we'll talk about more later. What comes into being in the place of Alexander's empire is it kind of splits up, and it splits up into four parts. Each part is ruled by someone who had been a general under Alexander. So these are all Greek kingdoms ruled by Greeks over another population, a non-Greek population. And the four are, according to Kyle, he says, this has been so historically realized that out of the wars of the Diadochs, which means the successors, the wars of the successors for the supremacy, four kingdoms arose toward the four regions of the earth into longer duration. That of Cassander in Macedonia toward the east, that of Lysimachus in Thracia and Bithynia towards the north, and finally that of Ptolemy, Egypt towards the south. I'm going to talk more about this division of the kingdom later. It's complicated. Verses 9 through 14. Out of one of them, that is one of the four that it was just talking about, out of one of them came another horn, which started small but grew in power to the south and to the east and toward the beautiful land. It grew until it reached the host of the heavens, and it threw some of the starry host down to the earth and trampled on them. It set itself up to be as great as the prince of the host. It took away the daily sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was brought low. Because of rebellion, the host of the saints and the daily sacrifice were given over to it. It prospered in everything it did, and truth was thrown to the ground. So now here's talk about the emergence of this small horn. So out of one of these four horns, we have this little horn that grows up. It starts out small, but it becomes significant as time goes on. This appears to be an Antiochus Epiphanes-like character. There was a ruler that came out of the Seleucid kingdom, which is the one in Syria. This is one of the four kingdoms that Alexander's empire broke up into. And Antiochus Epiphanes was one of those rulers that came out of one of those kingdoms later in time, several decades after Alexander the Great. Some think that this small horn is Antiochus Epiphanes. Some think it is not. I am of the opinion that it is, and so I'm going to proceed accordingly, but I'll talk a little bit more about why some people don't think it is later. The small horn went to the east and to the south and toward the beautiful land. So he goes, he's talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. He expands east towards what is now Turkey. He's starting in Syria, expanding east towards what is now Turkey. He expands south towards into Palestine and even threatens Egypt, as we'll see in just a second. And it says, and toward the beautiful land. And based on Jeremiah 3:19, it appears that that is an expression that was used to refer to Israel itself. So in Antiochus's expansion, he expands east, south, and also towards Israel. Now it says he threw down some from the host of heaven. What could that possibly be talking about? The host of heaven. There is precedent. Host just means a whole bunch. The hosts, plural, is often used to refer to an army, a large army. There is precedent for hosts to be referring to the Israelites when they were coming out of Egypt. They were referred to as hosts in Exodus 12:41, for instance, but there are other places where that same thing happens. But what would the host of heavens be, the host of heaven? Now, I'm going to tie this in with an ancient Near Eastern notion. There's only one commentator that I found that even hinted in this direction. I'm going to not only hint in this direction, I'm going to kind of put this together based on the assumption that this phrase originates in this particular notion of ancient Near Eastern culture. I'm also going to use this later in Daniel to explain something else that we see. There was this idea in the ancient Near Eastern world that everything that happens on this earth is a reflection of what's happening in the heavens. So if we have a battle in which the army from Kingdom X is defeated by the army from Kingdom Y, then what we know is that up in heaven, already, or more importantly, the God of Kingdom X got beat up by the God of Kingdom Y. So something happened in the heavenlies that then is reflected in events on earth. But notice that what's happening in the heavenlies, that's the primary reality. what happens on Earth is just a reflection of that primary activity. My suspicion, the best way I can make sense of this phrase, the host of heavens, is saying that Antiochus went to war with this host in the heavens that is the primary reality of which the hosts of Israel are a reflection. So Antiochus is doing something that human kings can't do. That is to say, he is kind of reaching into heaven, and he's tinkering in heaven. He's taken the hosts out of heaven. He throws them down to the earth where he can fight with them with his earthly force. I think that's what it's talking about. That is, the idea is that Antiochus can actually have an impact on the primary reality in heaven through what he's doing. That would be an amazing, if that's what the way he's thinking, that is truly amazing. That would be extremely arrogant. And then it talks about him trampling them. He threw some of the starry host down to the earth and trampled on them. And trampling, as I've already mentioned, is shown that word is repeated many times in Daniel. And it's typically what happens when one country defeats another country is they trample on that other country. And that's very common language. But in Daniel in particular, I think it takes on the connotation of oppressing somebody. That to trample is to oppress. And we'll talk about that more before we finish the book of Daniel. And this horn also set itself up to be as great as the prince of the host. So what is the prince? Who is the prince of the host? Well, it could be God, but it could also be the Messiah. I'm inclined to think that it's the Messiah. The word for prince is the Hebrew word sar, which just means official, but it could also mean general. And I think that's probably the case here. So it's the general of the host. And it's possible that God could be referred to as the general of the host. But usually a general is subservient to the king. And so that's why I would be slightly more inclined to see this as referring to the Messiah, but it's not clear. The small horn then discontinued the sacrifices at the temple in Jerusalem. And not just the sacrifices, it appears to be all of the cultic activities that happened at the temple. And by cultic activities, cult is a technical term that means the religious activities of one of these ancient peoples. So he discontinued all of the cultic operations at the temple. And God allowed the army of believers, the army of his people, God's people, and the sacrifices to be given over to this small horn. And as we'll talk about later, in fact, Antiochus Epiphanes persecuted the Jews heavily for a few years. Now it uses the word rebellion. It says, because of rebellion. And this word for rebellion shows up three times in the chapter. And it would appear, usually in reading the Old Testament, if I see somebody in rebellion in this kind of context, I assume it's the Israelites because they're always rebelling against God. But in this chapter, when it talks about rebellion, it seems to be rebellion of Antiochus, the Gentiles, against God. That's interesting because that you don't see rebellion against God by Gentiles referred to very often in the Old Testament. But I think that's the idea here, that Antiochus is rebelling against the Creator God. And that fits in with his pulling down the hosts of heaven and trampling on them, that he's doing battle not just with forces here in this world. He's doing battle with God himself. And that's the way he's seeing it. So I would take this sentence, I would paraphrase this sentence to be, while the horn was still acting arrogantly, while the horn was still in rebellion, the saints and the daily sacrifices were given over to it. A remarkable thing that God would turn those things over to this Gentile king in rebellion against God himself. The result of this is that truth was thrown to the ground. Golden Gay, one of the commentators that I read, says that truth is a more general word, and it points more generally to the way things are supposed to be. That could be the meaning here, that the way things are supposed to be was just thrown down and trampled on. I'm inclined to think, given the context, given what the message that you see throughout the prophetic works, I'm inclined to think that it's a little more specific than that. It may not be, but I think it might be a little bit more focused. And that it means that the story of who God is and what God is up to was thrown down on the ground and trampled. Because in these times of oppression, and the prophets underscore this many times, in these times of oppression, the thing that is difficult for believers is to keep in perspective and to continue to believe that God is the God who's in control of all this stuff, because it looks like God's not in control at all. That God is in control and that God is doing his salvific work, and he's taken care of his people, and they will be redeemed, and God's enemies will be completely destroyed. It is difficult to believe that story in the midst of all of this. So I suspect that that's really the more focused meaning of truth here, that Antiochus is mocking that whole perspective. That is ludicrous. That is absolutely unbelievable. Just look at all the power I have. Look what I can do. And I talked about that understanding of truth. I called it the gospel, and when I gave my introductory session, and you might remember that. Okay, so the small horn enjoyed immense success. And that is true of Antiochus for a few years, he did. Verses 13 and 14. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to him, "How long will it take for the vision to be fulfilled? The vision concerning the daily sacrifice, the rebellion that causes desolation, and the surrender of the sanctuary and of the host that will be trampled underfoot." He said to me, "It will take 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary will be reconsecrated." Okay, so there's apparently a conversation going on between two heavenly beings, presumably attendants that are attending to God in heaven. I'm assuming they're probably angels. I'll pretend they're angels. I don't really know. Daniel overhears part of their conversation. And one angel asks another a question. And the question that this angel asks is, "How long will it be that the temple, the sacrifices, and the army of saints will be given over to the small horn. Of all that Daniel saw in this vision, this seems to be the most important question, this most important issue. And the activity of the small horn is what captures his attention. The angel that's asking this must know that God is ultimately going to be victorious over the small horn. But the angel's disturbed by what's happening, and the angel wants to know, how long will God allow this to happen? When will God finally act? And the answer that's given is 2,300 evenings, mornings. I hate these kind of answers. It's a non-answer. Why can't he just say? I don't know. I don't know why he can't just say. But it's kind of a puzzle that is presented rather than an answer. We'll talk more about this because this is one of the harder issues that I had to deal with in this chapter. But at the end of this time, the temple will be rededicated. So there is a stopping point to this. The angel is certain. It reassures the other angel. There is a stopping point to this. It's only for a temporary period of time that this will happen. It talks about the rebellion that causes desolation. Again, we have the word rebellion. And I think rebellion here is referring to the activity of Antiochus Epiphanes. His activity, his rebellion against God, his direct assault on the God who is there. And it's a rebellion that causes desolation. And the desolation, I think, is just a reference to the chaos. But this is a play on words, apparently. The scholars think that this is related to the name of the God that Antiochus dedicated the temple to. So Antiochus took over the temple in Jerusalem and dedicated it to his own God, and that's Olympian Zeus. So that would be the head of the pantheon in Greek culture. But in Greek culture, in the Seleucid Empire, the name for Olympian Zeus was changed to fit into the culture of the area. And so the name that was used for Olympian Zeus was Baal Shaman. This phrase, the rebellion that causes desolation, is Pesha Shaman. So the last word is the same, and the second one is just a little bit scrambled. So this apparently, this term is used so often in this kind of context that scholars think that this is a play on words. But it's a reference to the rebellion of Antiochus that leads to absolute chaos. Now, just a note before we go on. Notice that the vision gets incrementally less symbolic as the vision progresses. It begins with animals and horns, and the only thing that's not symbolic early on is Susa and the canal. Everything else is symbolic. As we've progressed, now it's talking about armies, sacrifices, the temple, and the only thing that's symbolic, that's left that's symbolic, is the small horn, and maybe the stars and the host of heaven. So it's a little bit like the fog parting a bit, that it becomes a little clearer, a little easier to see. We do have some puzzles we have yet to solve, but it's not as highly symbolic as it had been. I'm not sure why that is. As I've mentioned before, we'll see in chapter 10, it's not symbolic at all. Chapter 10, chapter 11, there's virtually no symbolism left. So it slowly transforms. It becomes a different kind of thing. Verses 15 through 18. While I, Daniel, was watching the vision and trying to understand it, there before me stood one who looked like a man. And I heard a man's voice from the Ulai calling, Gabriel, tell this man the meaning of the vision. As he came near the place where I was standing, I was terrified and fell prostrate. Son of man, he said to me, understand that the vision concerns the time of the end. While he was speaking to me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground. Then he touched me and raised me to my feet. Now, I find this, it's just hard to understand what scene Daniel is trying to describe here. It's hard to know who is who and who's doing what, etc. This is my best guess. So Daniel continues to see in this same dream, he sees he sees at least one individual, I think two individuals, and they are going to explain to him what he has seen in the vision up to now. So it's an interpretation within the vision, just like we saw in chapter 7. Before Daniel is this man-like being standing before him. Now, it's not clear whether that's Gabriel or whether that's someone else. Most of the commentators seem to think that this is someone else. I think that could very well be. And in fact, when it says looked like a man, I'm wondering if it's talking about the Son of Man talked about in chapter 7. If that's true, then what we're talking about would be presumably the Messiah here that Daniel is seeing, and this Messiah figure is either suspended over the canal or right next to the canal, but the voice comes from there, probably the voice from this man-like being. And this man-like being tells Gabriel, who we know is the archangel, tells Gabriel to fill Daniel in on the meaning of the vision. So Gabriel then comes over to where Daniel is, and Daniel just falls down on his face in front of Gabriel in the most respectful expression, form of action, gesture that one can make in that culture. But Gabriel then raises him up. Now, why Daniel didn't fall down like this before the man-like creature, I don't know. Maybe the man-like creature was too far away. It's not clear. But Gabriel then, Daniel goes into a trance. He's apparently loses consciousness or something. Daniel wakes him up and then causes him to stand up. Now, I don't understand what all of this choreography means. My suspicion is that it's significant, and that one that was closer to the culture would understand all of the significance of this, but I just don't know enough to be able to give significance to all of that. Gabriel says that this is, understand that the vision concerns the time of the end. That expression, time of the end, we're gonna see that expression show up again in the passage, and I'll talk about it more later. That's a significant, what that means is significant for the interpretation of the passage as a whole. Verses 19 to 26, he said, I'm going to tell you what will happen later in the time of wrath, because the vision concerns the appointed time of the end. The two-horned ram that you saw represents the kings of Media and Persia. The shaggy goat is the king of Greece. and the large horn between his eyes is the first king. The four horns that replace the one that was broken off represent four kingdoms that will emerge from his kingdom, but will not have the same power. In the latter part of their reign, when rebels have become completely wicked, a stern-faced king, a master of intrigue, will arise. He will become very strong, but not by his own power. He will cause astounding devastation and will succeed in whatever he does. He will destroy the mighty men and the holy people. He will cause deceit to prosper, and he will consider himself superior. When they feel secure, he will destroy many and take his stand against the Prince of Princes. Yet he will be destroyed, but not by human power. So Gabriel interprets the dream. And he says, I'm going to tell you what will happen later in the time of wrath, because the vision concerns the appointed time of the end. This is very difficult. There are a lot of opinions as to what this means, and then that has implications for the rest of the chapter. I'm just going to give you my best guess so far. The time of wrath appears to be a reference to the judgment that is going on against Israel, against Judah, at the time of Daniel. Now, there's some indication in other Old Testament texts that the wrath, the period of wrath, the time of wrath of God, extends from the time when the Babylonians conquered Judah initially through till the time that the temple was rededicated. But that's all considered to be the time of the wrath of God. Now, from my perspective, that's awfully strange, because it doesn't appear to me that God's wrath ends with the rededication of the temple. It isn't a whole lot later when Judah is incorporated into the Roman Empire, and then it's in 70 AD that Jerusalem is completely destroyed and the Jews are scattered all over the world. So how do you draw a line? Where do you say that God's judgment of his people, his wrath towards them, ends, given that there are other things down line in history that seem to be God's wrath as well? I don't know the answer to that question. But I don't see a better solution to the question of what does the time of wrath mean in this verse. So I'm going to adopt that meaning, that the time of wrath is from the period of time when Babylon takes Judah until the rededication of the temple. Then it says, because the vision concerns the appointed time of the end. Now, I mentioned earlier in verse 17 that there was this idea, the time of the end. The wording in 17 is slightly different, but I am assuming that even though the wording's a little bit different, that both of these are referring to the same thing. And I think what they're referring to is the time when Jesus returns. And it's because of this phrase, that this is referring to the end, that there are some people who say, well, this can't be Antiochus because that's a long ways from the end. So that can't be, it can't be talking about Antiochus. It has to be talking about the Antichrist. I think at this point, I think that the vision is talking about Antiochus, but the vision is pointing to the end of history. So when it says that it's because the vision concerns the appointed time of the end. The vision is about Antiochus, but it's related to events that occur at the end of time, at the time of the return of the Messiah. Because Antiochus is just a foretaste of the Antichrist to come. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. Okay, we've already talked about his interpretation of the two animals. I won't go through that again. But then it talks about the small horn, and he gives more details with respect to the small horn, who, as I've said, I think is Antiochus Epiphanes. Just as the four kingdoms are waning in power and about to die out, a bad king is going to emerge. And this bad out of one of those. And that bad king is rash. He's deceitful. But he's going to become strong and successful. He will destroy the mighty man and the holy people. He will succeed by treachery. He will be arrogant. He will rise up against the prince of princes. He will not die in the hands of another person. He's going to die by some other means. Okay, we'll talk about all of that shortly when I talk about Antiochus Epiphanes as a historical person. Last two verses. The vision of the evenings and the mornings that has been given you is true, but seal up the vision, for it concerns the distant future. I, Daniel, was exhausted and lay ill for several days. Then I got up and went about the king's business. I was appalled by the vision. It was beyond understanding. So the vision, Gabriel says, the vision is about the vision of the evenings and the mornings. So I think it's the vision that has just been described in chapter 8. It is about an arrogant ruler interfering in the activities of the temple. That's all true. But it will not happen soon. So Daniel's told to seal up the vision. And I think several commentators have mentioned this, and I think it's probably true, that the sealing up is not to hide it, but rather to preserve it. So seal it up, that is, make it safe, so that it will be around when it's really relevant. I think that's the idea. And Daniel, as a result of seeing this vision, is exhausted and sick. He's bedridden for several days, and he's astonished, appalled, and he can't understand what it all meant. So he doesn't fully understand what he's seen, even after Gabriel interpreted it for him. Those interpretations are a little lacking in fullness. But he still doesn't understand it fully, but he knows it's bad. He knows it's extremely ominous, and it's so upsetting that for days he can't get out of bed. As I've mentioned before, and I'll underscore it again, to be called to be a prophet is hard duty. It is not fun to be a prophet. And that's consistently the case. There may be only one or two exceptions that I can think of. Okay. Antiochus Epiphanes as the historical person. I'm going to tell you a little bit about him as from what we know about him historically, and you'll see that it fits really well with the description that we've already seen in the chapter. Antiochus Epiphanes was the son of a king in Syria, a Seleucid king in Syria, but he was the youngest son of several sons, and I'm not sure exactly how many. I don't know if historians know many, but there were several sons. So he is very unlikely to inherit power. And as the Romans were wont to do during this time period, they took princes from kingdoms that were on the outskirts of their empire. They would take princes and they would take them back to Rome, where they would be educated. It was all in the name of being very good to the kings out on the outskirts of their empire, by training, giving their sons the best training that was possible in the world. But really, it was taking hostages. So he was taken hostage, taken to Rome, where he grew up, where he was educated. So Antiochus knew the Romans, and he knew the way the Romans operated. In 175, Antiochus's brother, Seleucus, and Seleucus the something, I can't remember which one it is, he was assassinated by a man by the name of Heliodorus, and Heliodorus wanted to take power. But a king on the outskirts of the Roman Empire, it was Eumenes II of Pergamum, he was a friend of Antiochus, helped him sneak out of Rome and sneak back to Syria so that he could take advantage of the intrigue that was happening and maybe take power. So Antiochus came back, and he did indeed achieve power as a regent of one of the sons of Seleucus. So Seleucus was a brother of Antiochus, and it was one of his sons, so a nephew of Antiochus, that Antiochus helped get to the throne, and then Antiochus was his regent. Common, if a king was young, it would generally be a regent who would be appointed to manage affairs for the young king. So Antiochus became regent, and not much later, he then murdered his nephew so that Antiochus could be the sole ruler. When he became king, he named himself King Antiochus God Manifest. That's what Epiphanes stands for. Theos Epiphanes. So God Manifest. And as we'll see, some people called him, instead of Epiphanes, they called him Epimanes, which means mad, crazy. He becomes king. He is very successful in consolidating his power, expanding the territory that's under his control, and he even expands to the south and threatens to take control of Egypt, which Egypt had been under the Ptolemies, had been the stronger kingdom of the four kingdoms that Alexander's empire broke up into. It had been stronger than the Seleucid Empire for a long time, but its power started to wane about the time that Antiochus came along, and Antiochus threatens the existence of Egypt. The Ptolemies had been in control of Palestine for most of the time after Alexander died. They controlled it, they took tribute from that area, but they didn't interfere with Judea religiously or socially very much. They pretty much let the Jews do their thing. They just had to pay their money to the Ptolemies in Egypt. But Antiochus now has taken control of Palestine and is moving towards Egypt. In 168, Antiochus actually attacked Egypt and was on Egyptian soil and was making his way to the capital of Egypt, when Rome intervened. And let me read you, this is a paragraph from the Wikipedia article on Antiochus Epiphanes, but this is a very famous incident from Roman history. Before he reached Alexandria, that is, before Antiochus reached Alexandria, his path was blocked by a single elderly Roman ambassador named Gaius Papilius Laius, who delivered a message from the Roman Senate directing Antiochus to withdraw his armies from Egypt and Cyprus or consider himself in a state of war with the Roman Republic. Antiochus said he would discuss it with his council, whereupon the Roman envoy drew a line in the sand around Antiochus and said, "Before you leave this circle, give me a reply that I can take back to the Roman Senate." This implied Rome would declare war if the king stepped out of the circle without committing to leave Egypt immediately. Weighing his options, Antiochus decided to withdraw. Only then did Pompilius agree to shake hands with him. I'm not sure, but I think this story is the origin for the saying to draw a line in the sand. In any case, Antiochus knew from his experience, you don't mess with the Romans. And so he capitulated right there on the spot when faced with the option, the decision that he had to make. While Antiochus was in Egypt, standing in the middle of that circle in the sand, in Palestine, the pro-Egyptian party was optimistic that Egypt would defeat Antiochus. And so they moved to take control of the temple and to establish a pro-Egypt regime in Jerusalem. But the Egyptians, the Ptolemies, didn't win. And Antiochus, when he left Egypt, he goes back to Jerusalem and he is furious. And he puts down the rebellion brutally. This is another paragraph from the Wikipedia article. According to the authors of the books of the Maccabees, while Antiochus was busy in Egypt, a rumor spread that he had been killed. In Judea, the deposed high priest Jason gathered a force of 1,000 soldiers and made a surprise attack on the city of Jerusalem. Menelaus, the high priest appointed by Antiochus, was forced to flee Jerusalem during a riot. King Antiochus returned from Egypt in 168 BC, enraged by his defeat. He attacked Jerusalem and restored Menelaus, then executed many Jews. And here next is a paragraph that comes from the Maccabees. The first, second, third, and fourth Maccabees are about this period of time, in particular about Antiochus and the Hasmonean overthrow of the Seleucid control of Judea. Here's a paragraph from the Maccabees. When these things were reported to the king, he thought that Judea was in revolt. Raging like a wild animal, he set out from Egypt and took Jerusalem by storm. He ordered his soldiers to cut down without mercy those whom they met and to slay those who took refuge in their houses. There was a massacre of young and old, a killing of women and children, a slaughter of virgins and infants. In the space of 3 days, 80,000 were lost, 40,000 meeting a violent death, and the same number being sold into slavery. Following this, then, there was heavy persecution of the pro-Egypt party, the traditionalists, the ones who held tightly to traditional Jewish customs. And this is when he stopped the cultic practices in the temple, and that lasted for about 3 years. This eventually created a backlash, and the Jews, over a period of several years, were able to force the Seleucids out of Judea completely, and they were able to rededicate the temple in a relatively short time, that is, in 164, they were able to gain control of the temple and rededicate it. Antiochus died in 164. He was at war, and I can't remember. I think it was against the Parthians. And there are various accounts of what the cause of death was, but most scholars think it was probably disease. There are other more gory stories that are reported in the Jewish sources, but most historians discount those as wishful thinking. But he did die, in all likelihood, apparently died of disease and not at the hand of another man, which is what the vision had said. What kind of person was this? It's interesting. I was reading a book by Jerry Kover, who is a Jew who grew up in Russia and then migrated to Israel when Israel was just forming as a state. And he was one of the first professors at the Hebrew University. He points out that Antiochus was not pure evil, according to the historical sources that we have, especially the non-Jewish historical sources, the Greek and Roman historians. Let me read something that this is a paragraph from Jerry Kober's book with respect to Antiochus. He says, "No one, of course, sees in Antiochus's character the sole reason for the persecution, but nearly all scholars have been sensible of those elements in his makeup which lent the final impulse to the execution of the decrees. There's a certain sense in this emphasis. Even in the ancient world, Antiochus's strange traits of character attracted the attention of historians. As the Hellenistic authors reflect him, Antiochus appears as a person in whom the positive and negative were mingled in equal proportion. Jewish historiography has made him the evil one, a tyrant of unparalleled brutality. But clearly this distorts the picture and cannot be used to characterize him, for justice and impartiality are not to be looked for from foes. Nor is there, on the other hand, an adequate basis for an idealization of Antiochus." Okay, later, Jerry Kover goes on to say, "Like Nero, 200 years after him, he liked to participate personally in theater performances. Once during a magnificent festival, which he was holding at Antioch, he appeared on the stage before the audience as an actor and began to dance with the other players. The Greeks had never seen their king in such a role, and many left the banqueting hall in shame. His behavior toward the other people was full of contradictions and sudden surprises, for he was silent in the company of his best friends and talkative with strangers. To some he gave precious gifts such as silver and gold, to others, without reason, worthless objects such as dates and dice. Irritable and nervous, full of profound inner contradictions, ever striving to do something extraordinary and to astound the world, this was the figure cut by King Antiochus in the eyes of his Greek contemporaries. Hence it is not to be wondered at that humorists mocked him and called him in jest Epimanes instead of Epiphanes, so mad instead of God manifest." So if he's not pure evil, then why did he persecute the Jews? Jerry Kover gives three reasons. He discounts the first two, and then the third is the one that he advances as the answer to the question why he persecuted the Jews. The first answer he gives is he wanted to unify the empire by Hellenizing it. We know that he encouraged the establishment of Hellenized cities. If a city in his empire became Hellenized, sufficiently Hellenized, and had to meet certain criteria, then it qualified as a Hellenized city and got a whole bunch of perks. There were a whole bunch of benefits that came from having that status. So he encouraged this kind of thing in order to spread Hellenistic or Greek culture so that it would be easier to keep the empire united. And this goes I talked about this much earlier in Daniel, talking about how the problem of empire being how you hold this thing together. And Antiochus is struggling with that. Tariq Over says his design was not to build new Greek cities, but to intensify the Hellenism of those that already existed. Also to turn the ancient Oriental towns, which had not yet been Hellenized, into Greek polis, that is, cities, by granting them special political privileges. It is not prominent in the literature, but Tariq Over pieces together the evidence, and it would appear that they were in the process of making Jerusalem one of those Greek cities. And it was going to be named Antioch at Jerusalem. Tariq Over says, it has already been observed that Antioch at Jerusalem also was intended as a link in the long chain of strongholds of the new Hellenism in the Seleucid Empire. They resisted Hellenization. Tariq Over says, from all these passages, the fact emerges clearly that Epiphanes' contemporaries and the king himself saw the reason for the persecutions in the Jews' obstinate refusal to exchange their traditional way of life for Greek ways. The forcible Hellenization of the Jews was the reason for the persecution. So he persecuted them because they wouldn't Hellenize, and he wanted them to Hellenize. The second reason gets to why he wanted to Hellenize, and that's for unification of his empire. Tariq Over's comment with respect to this: this doctrine holds that Antiochus sought to strengthen his crumbling kingdom by political centralization and cultural unification. The establishment of one religion for all the people of the state was part of his plan for reform. Okay, so they resisted Hellenization, which meant that they were resisting his efforts to unify the empire. But Tariq Over gives a third reason. He says, the main reason for persecution was that he came to see the traditionalists as his enemy. So those who held to traditional Jewish practices, he came to see them as his enemies. Tariq Over says, logic demands the conclusion that after Jason's failure, the control of the city passed to the opponents of the king, the enemies of the Hellenizers. This means that a very significant thing had occurred in Jerusalem, namely a people's revolt against Jason and the overthrow of the rule of the Hellenizers in the city, Antioch at Jerusalem, was liquidated, and the people was preparing to return to its traditional form of government. It is clear that Antiochus now regarded Jerusalem as a hostile city and behaved towards it accordingly. I think it's all three of those. They're all part of it. I don't know why he needs to eliminate the first two, but all three of them fit together. These are all of a piece and the reason why Antiochus persecuted the Jews. Okay, I don't have much time. I'm going to have to do this quickly. I'm going to address a question that seems like it should be obvious, but it's not. And the question is, how do we know when a prophecy is fulfilled? I mean, you say, well, when it happens. But it's not as easy as that. It says in the prophecy that Alexander the Great was the first king of Macedonia. It mentions that in verse 21. So is that wrong? Or was Alexander the first king of Macedonia? We know he wasn't the first king of Macedonia. His father was king before him. There were probably kings before that. But Alexander was the first king of the Macedonian Empire. As it expanded to the east, it was clear Alexander was the originator of what we think of as the Macedonian Empire. So in that sense, it's correct, but technically, it's questionable. Let's take another example. It says that the empire was divided into four kingdoms upon the death of Alexander. Before looking at that, if you were to ask me into how many pieces was the empire of Alexander divided after he died, I could give you I could give you five or six defensible answers. Because it starts out two, and then it's like 10 or 12, and then it gets reduced down to about six. At one point, it's like three, four. All of those would be justified, defensible answers. And if you wonder, I wrote down the link in my notes to a Wikipedia article on the successors of Alexander. And you can go look at it. You can read it. It is very interesting, but it is a very complicated process. It isn't until 20 years after Alexander dies that it kind of settles down to four. So there's a sense in which four is the best answer, but it takes 20 years before you reach that state. And if you wait longer, you get down to three and you get less. So it is not the answer to the question, how many entities did the Macedonian Empire devolve into after Alexander's death is not an easy question to answer. It all depends on what time frame you're looking at. So sometimes it's hard to know what fulfills a prophecy. Prophecies by nature are very simplistic, and yet historical realities are very complex. And so it's hard to know when a simplistic prediction maps onto a historical reality. And we're going to run into this again in chapter 11, but there are some people who point to these two issues that I raised and say, well, this can't be talking about Antiochus because this doesn't fit the time period of Antiochus. Well, there's a sense in which they're right, but there's another sense in which they're wrong. So it's a difficult issue. Okay, was Antiochus the little horn of Daniel in chapter 8? Some balk at this association. They say that the number 2,300 doesn't work out. Historically, it appears that the period of time when the sacrifices were not given was about 1,090 days. So it's about 3 years and 10 days. But that's far from the 2,300. So some people have proposed, well, it says morning, evenings. So if you want to know that, so that would be referring to the morning sacrifices and the evening sacrifices. So if you want to know how many sacrifices, how many days it is, that, so 2,300 is the total of the morning sacrifices and the evening sacrifices that didn't happen. If you want to know the total number of days, divide that by two. If you divide that by two, then you get 1,150, which is a lot closer to the actual number than the 2,300. But can you do that? Does that make sense? Is that what was intended by the author? So some people say, no, it's got to be 2,300 days, but we can extend earlier the time of the beginning back to the time when Jason became the high priest. Jason was appointed by Antiochus. So we'll go way back there. That's when the cultic practices of the temple were no longer valid. And then leave the end when it was rededicated, and you get something approaching 2,300. Others say, no, the beginning is right. When Antiochus said no more sacrifices on the temple, that date is right. But we need to put the ending time at a much later date. It's when the Seleucids are finally kicked out of Judea completely. Others say it's symbolic, which is a nice answer because you can always use it. But then explain the symbolism, and that gets difficult. The other reason that people don't want to associate this with Antiochus is one I've already alluded to, and that is it says this prophecy has to do with the end of time, and they assume that that's at the time when Jesus returns. So it has to be talking about the Antichrist rather than Antiochus. It seems to me that Antiochus is a very good fit. I don't I just trust that the number 2,300 works out. I don't know how, but I just trust that that number works out. And as I have explained, I understand the end of time differently than those who say that this has to be about the Antichrist. And I'll touch on that. Okay, I'll try to sum this up in just a couple of minutes so I don't keep you too long. What does this vision contribute to our knowledge of empire? Well, first we learn that empires will not be peacefully related to one another. We aren't going to have a peaceful transition of power between these empires. It's going to be brutal. There will be conflicts for dominance between these different empires, and we see that in this chapter. We also see the anti-God character of empire, and that becomes more apparent when a given emperor chooses to use his power to destroy the people. And the Antiochus Epiphanes was an example of this phenomenon, but he's not the last. That this, in a sense, serves as a prediction of the Antichrist to come. Antiochus was going to come from the time of Daniel. Antiochus comes along just, 300 years later? So that's a short-term prediction. Antiochus comes just a few centuries later, and fulfilling up yet, that is at the end, which is the Antichrist. So there will be another, and I think clearly there have been others in between Antiochus and the ultimate Antichrist who have been Antichrists also. But there will be an ultimate Antichrist at the end, and a lot of the qualities that Antiochus has will be true of that ultimate Antichrist as well. And we'll see more about that when we get into chapter 11. Daniel was left horrified and bedridden for several days after the vision. So once again, we don't see God giving him encouragement or consolation. He is just left a mess. There is a place for that. Okay, that's all I've got. I see that there are a couple of questions. I will answer these questions, and then if there are other questions, I'll answer those as well. Robbie asks, if you take Prince to be the Messiah, do you mean Jesus or another anointed in Israel at the time of the Antiochus, our high priest anointed? My recollection is that, I'm trying to remember, I think there's one high priest that's referred to as being anointed, but generally speaking, it is a ruler that is referred to as being anointed. There are prophets that are anointed. Elisha is anointed, but I don't think typically the high priest is. By Messiah, I meant the Messiah. I meant Jesus, the Christ. And so I'm taking the prince in the vision to be the reference to the prince in the vision to be a reference to Jesus Christ. Another question from Robbie: could the man-like creature be a theophany? And that's absolutely true. That could be, just as it's possible that the prince of the hosts is also a reference to God as well and not to the Messiah. Those are both, I think, very possible. Okay. Thanks for your attention, and have a good Father's Day, and we will take up chapter 9 next week. Thanks. Bye.